Are you ready to have an intelligent, no BS discussion about social justice issues in America and around the world? Then join us for another episode of The First Shot with your host, Nick Brannigan. Let's get started.
And hey, everybody, and welcome to the, I don't know what I'm going to call it yet, but we're going to call it something cool for, we're doing a roundtable for The First Shot. It's been a while. You haven't heard me or heard this voice in some time. It's your boy, Nick, and we are back. Had to take some time off, but we're going to be kicking it now. So we're going to start off a series. This is going to be a roundtable series of people, other human beings that share the same ideas, the same logic as you do, our listeners. If you're listening to this podcast, you know, you already know what it's about because you've read and you've heard other episodes. But if you have never yet listened to this podcast, we talk about issues that affect everyone and everything in this world, not just in particular countries or particular areas. It affects all of us in one way, shape, or form. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our guests. I'm going to give you a little background on who they are. So first, we're going to start off with Polly and Austin. Now, Polly and Austin, they're a married couple who happen to be interracial. I hate using that term. I hate putting any labels on people, but we're going to let you know who you're talking to so you can, or who you're listening to, excuse me, so you can actually get an idea as where they come from, where they're standing with their viewpoints. Polly is an author and the founder of Beautifully Chaotic Podcast, which is awesome, by the way. So if you have a chance, you can find her. You can find her on Spotify and on, everywhere pretty much, you know, all platforms, Apple Podcasts or whatnot. So Beautifully Chaotic Podcast, and that's Polly. She, again, is an author, and she is a wonderful person. Listen to her show. I do. Austin, who is her husband, is an IT guru who works in the tech industry. He is a great guy, and sometimes we call him Felipe, but I don't know why. So these two wonderful young people are a force to be reckoned with. So that's Polly and Austin. So they're going to be on board with us today. Ricardo's with us. This gentleman is a founder of Given Values, which is a nonprofit organization that is based in Toronto, Canada, which helps provide for those less fortunate than us, those who are food and basic necessities insecure within his community. This outreach also helps at-risk children in the community. And just in my opinion, that's a huge kudos. Anything to do with children, I'm there for it. They also offer emergency food hampers, new coats for kids and youths, and they have Feed the Community meetups. So Ricardo, you're going to hear from him, and we're going to have a good discussion. But it's a pleasure to have him and an honor to have him on the show as well. Last but not least, we have another wonderful lady. Her name is Sarah Dickinson. She is an accomplished author. Okay, she authored a book called Silver Spoons, One's Journey Through Addiction. Now, this is a must read for those who would like to have some insight into this serious subject. When it comes to addiction, there are so many different, facets or ways to look at it, but it's great to have a point of view, almost like a first person point of view. So this is something you definitely want to pick up. I believe it would be on Amazon Books, if I'm not mistaken, Sarah. Is that correct?
It's actually on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
There you go. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you could check that out. Also, Sarah is also a vocal force when it comes to social justice issues. So we are definitely looking forward to her input on the show, on this episode. So before we even get into anything else, I'm going to give you a disclaimer. Okay, we're going to talk about racism, plain and simple. That's what today's episode is going to be about, racism. If you don't have thick skin, if you don't have an intelligent and a logical discussion about the subject, then I would suggest not listening to this episode. You can always agree to disagree on things, but the point of this series and all of our episodes are for education. If you don't have the proper training and tools to fight, you will not win. That's plain and simple. I know my listeners are smart and bold, so will enjoy the series. And I, again, as you've always heard from me, I always appreciate your feedback and to join the conversation however you can. So let's go ahead and let's start off with Polly. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Polly.
I'm an author, like Nick said earlier. I'm also the host of Beautifully Chaotic's podcast. You can find me on all of the podcasts, wherever you can find podcasts, you can find me. I'm 21 years old. I am a Black American. I grew up in Southern Louisiana, but I now live in North Carolina with my lovely husband.
Nollins. Louisiana,
what up? All right, so we're going to go ahead. We're going to keep this going. That's true. That's a good one. Austin, tell us a little bit about yourself, sir.
So first things first, my name's Austin. I'm not as cool as everyone else. I'm not an author or anything. But I'm a system administrator and I do networking. Currently in college for cybersecurity, which is pretty much I'm in school to learn how to protect your network from intruders, whether it's people trying to steal your data or how to protect your data from, let's say, a hotel takes your information. I'm trying to learn how to be part of a team to protect your information from being stolen. Polly's the muscle of the group, so that's all I got.
So right. Austin, are you creating a cloud to scramble up like passwords or scramble up people's information, so it's not only going to be in one location, so it's easier for cyber thieves to find your information like on one cloud itself, or you just scramble it?
Essentially, what I'll be able to do is I can set up different tools to whenever it goes from you. Let's say you have your information and you give it to a hotel. The hotel will encrypt the data and send it to the cloud, so it stores it and someone can't steal it.
There you go. Okay.
And there's different ways
to
do it.
Can you teach me?
What was that?
Can you teach me to not be like tech retarded?
I could try my best.
He taught me.
Definitely.
Ricardo, tell us a little bit about yourself, sir.
Well, my name is Ricardo. Originally, I'm Jamaican Cuban. 44 years old as of Tuesday that just passed. Well, yeah,
Wednesday. Happy birthday!
The 22nd was my birthday, so you know I celebrated that. Originally, like I said, I came from Jamaica. Came to Canada in the 80s, and then I did a lot of stuff here in Canada, and then I moved to the United States is when I moved to New York in Brooklyn for about 9 years. Then I left from Brooklyn, and then I went down south, more like Baltimore, Washington, and then I stopped in Atlanta. And I love Louisiana. I love the food in Louisiana. So,
oh, yeah.
Kudos to Polly. You know, I love Atlanta. I love Louisiana. I love Baton Rouge. I love anything to do with New Orleans. I love it. So a little bit about myself. I created Given Values and a company I think that just helps a lot of folks that, you know, people that's living a decent life don't really look at too much. And I felt to myself that I have a purpose and shining light on, and you know, me, I'm being privileged by, I can cook any meal I want every day. Sometimes we don't even cook it. Sometimes we probably let the food go bad, and then there's people out there that's unfortunate that needs it. So this is where my passion lies. I cry sometimes when I see homeless people and I see children in need and people that's getting hurt. And I guess that's what I've been ordained to do, is to start this business to try to see if I can help as much people as I can.
Amen. Amen. Well, thank you for that. And we also have Sarah. So Sarah, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Sarah and I'm an author. I wrote my first book, obviously, about a very personal experience of somebody who's really close to me who struggled with addiction. And I am currently back in school to get my MSW with a secondary license in addiction studies and counseling. And I'm working on a book about sexism and domestic violence, different aspects of domestic violence. I have two kids, and I'm trying really, really hard to sound like the intelligent, educated person I am and not curse a lot because we're talking about a subject that really makes me want to curse a lot.
Yeah.
And if Ricardo is living in Canada, I'm saying that we should really be friends because if the election goes a certain way in November, I need you to get me over the border.
I got you.
Okay. That really matters to me right now because I'd be scared to live here in December if it's still what it is now. So.
Yep.
That's, so we're gonna touch on that, and maybe you might have a different perception after I kind of lay a little thing out for you so you could be mindful about.
Okay. I always try to be open-minded, so I'll listen.
Yeah, if we don't get to that in this episode, we're gonna have another one, so we'll be good. So basically, just moving forward, you know, you've met everybody here on the panel. It's a good group, good solid group, and we're going to go ahead and jump right in right now. So I'm going to go ahead and do this like a round robin style. So I will ask each, you know, we'll start off with Polly, and then it'll go to Austin and Sarah and then Ricardo. I'm going to ask a question, and if you need me to repeat the question, that's fine, but I want each of you to give your own answer to it, no matter how short or how long. It is what it is. So, and then I'll answer it at the end, you know, after you guys, and I'll give you my opinion on it as well. So the first question is, and if you're ready, Polly, you're up first, batter up. So has racism and bigotry had a direct impact on your life? And if so, how? And can you give us an example?
Okay, so that's definitely a yes. So growing up in Southern Louisiana, where I was kind of sheltered from it, but once I got older and started working and stuff, it dealt with a lot. I worked at my first job with Subway. I was 16. My first real experience with racism was I was working the cashier one day and a guy came in. And he stared at me the entire time he was making his sandwich. And then when he got to the register, he asked the girl who was making the sandwich, which was a white girl, if she could ring him up. And she was like, I can't. I'm not on the register. It's under her. She has to ring you up. And I was just like, okay, well, I guess we're doing this. And he gets there and I tell him his total. And he throws the money on the counter and just looks at me, like staring me down. And I was just like, okay. And I had to give him change. And he jacked the change out my hand and was like, I refuse to touch you. And then he just walked away. And I was just like, well, have a good day, sir. So, yeah.
Wow.
That was the first little experience I got. But it just got worse from there. And it's all just the same. They either outright racism or they just have microaggressions here or there. Like, oh, you sure you want to wear your hair like that? You know, it doesn't look exactly professional when I have my afro or something.
Unreal. But it's not surprising. It's not surprising.
Well, at least you don't have no weave in your hair. And if it's natural afro, it's boom. It's good.
I actually shaved my head recently.
You did?
She did. Yes, she did. She did that.
What?
It's a fresh start. It's a fresh start. There you go. No, and you know, it's interesting. You had it at a young age, one. Two, it's blatant, of course. You're dealing with an absolute moron. That they can't even hide it well in public. That's, you know, I mean, come on. We're going to move on. So that's Polly. I mean, we have some more. We have more for you. So Austin. Felipe.
You know, I don't think I've ever actually really experienced racism in my life. It was weird. Well, I say that because maybe I didn't realize it at the time. Well, when I went to high school, I was the only white dude at school. Everybody, it was like, honestly, like 92% black people and like 8%, well, I'd say like 7% Hispanic and like 1% white. Like, when I played baseball all 4 years in high school, I was playing baseball since eighth grade, but I was always like the only white dude on the team. And everybody was cool with me. Like, when I was in ninth grade, they called me everybody's white boy, and I guess maybe that could be considered racist. I don't know. I don't think it was, but I thought it was cool. But for the most part, you know, I grew up in pretty much the same place as Polly, Southern Louisiana, and we lived two towns. Well, went to the schools in two different places, and I guess we really had different experience. And
so, I don't know. So let me ask you this though. They said that to you. They called you their
everybody white boy.
Yeah. But it was in jest. It wasn't ever in
no,
in
it wasn't like any ever malice, derogatory or anything. It was always what up.
Right.
Interesting. That means you got a black pass. If a black man said that to you, that means you got a black pass. That you're everybody's white boy. That means you're cool as hell. That means that you know what I'm saying. That means you're non-judging. You're non-judgmental. That means you come across as not even being a color. You just came across as being a freaking cool dude. You know what I mean? They might say that, hey man, this is a cool ass white boy. You know what I'm saying? So that's what it is.
Wow. Oh, I got you completely, because that's exactly what I took it as, because I never took it as offense or anything, which is cool. I was just cool with everybody. Like, I had no problems with anybody. There was no reason to have beef, man. We was all going to school for the same thing. Get out of there.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, if you hear this, and it's interesting from Austin, you know, to look back, you can say, I've never really experienced anything. And that's that's really interesting. Hold on. He's got a story, guys.
I think I did experience racism once. I did. It was when I was dating my ex-girlfriend. She was also black. And we got stopped by a cop. And she was like freaking out. And he looked at her like, why are you driving? Why is the white dude in the passenger seat and she driving? And he just, it felt off, you know? Like,
wow.
That was like probably the first time I ever experienced, like, hearing the stories about cops and stopping black people. Like, that was actually the first time I ever experienced that. And it was awful.
Huh. So why are you driving?
It was her mama's whip.
What the hell does it matter?
Like,
like, yeah, but I'm just saying to him, what does it matter?
Oh yeah, yeah, so like
that the black girl is supposed to be in the passenger seat or the back seat. Basically, what he's saying is like, you know, it's more of a power thing. It's more of a dominance thing that you're looking at.
Correct. Correct. And that damn. Well, so you did experience
it. Yeah, I did experience it. And I thought about it. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you witnessed it firsthand, basically.
But no, yeah, I've seen it. Like, it wasn't a video. It was like actual. It was crazy. The feeling was, it was awful. It was off. And it was like the whole ride back, it was just quiet. Like, that's probably the only time.
Yeah, because you don't know how to process that. You know what I mean?
Oh, I understand completely.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. Well, wow. We'll come back to that too. So I guess the next person would be Sarah.
Sarah.
Yes. So,
I think, especially you, Nick, because you read the article that I wrote about white people. Mm-hmm. I don't think my comment is going to shock you, but I think it might be, some people might take it as a controversial comment. My experiences are that white people don't experience racism. We might experience bigotry from time to time, where people are going to judge us because we're white, or maybe have assumptions about us or stereotypes, but we don't experience racism. Like, that's my core belief, that racism is a lot more than just a bigoted assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And saying that, I've never experienced racism. Nobody's ever
been able to effectively, I mean, I've been had assumptions made about me because I was white, but nobody's been able to ever really affect my life in any aspect because I was white. And I think that's the big difference between racism and bigotry.
Right.
The only real experience, like the first experience I had about racism was not for me. It was for my best friend at the time, which still, well, now she's like, I call her my sister because we've known each other since like second grade, was watching what was done to her. Like I've witnessed racism. I've been, you know, working 16, being 16, I had a job at Caldor where two black women came in and I was asked to follow them. And I refused kind of thing, but, yeah, I'm going to stand by the fact that white people can't be affected, not be affected, but white people don't experience racism for being white.
We'll have to post a link to that article too that you wrote because it was very good.
Yes, and as everybody knows, when you get a view, you get money. And yeah, so you get paid to write an article, and then you get paid, like you get in extras every time you get views, you get clicks, you get more added to it. And everything from that article is going for the Black Lives Matter movement. So I didn't get paid for it. So
can I?
Perfect.
Okay, so I don't know if we can do discussions right now, but I kind of want to say something. So me, I obviously don't date within my race. But Sarah, you said white people can't experience racism. So I want to ask, what do you think this is? So I'm very open with not dating. Like I can date black people, but I normally date outside of my race. And there's a lot of times where I've been with my white boyfriend or my Hispanic boyfriend or something, and they had a few black people that was like, oh, what are you doing with him? Like that, he's just going to ruin your life. He would never love you like a black person can love you. And what do you call that? Like, is that racism towards them or is it bigotry?
Well, I think I would call it more bigotry because, and I'm not saying that I'm right, but the way that my parents raised me was that racism was more than just being ignorant, and it was more than just hate. It was power, and it was a power to effectively hold down or keep people from having, you know, the same basic things that a white person has. So, like, you know what I mean? Like, yes, white people can get discrimination of judgments being made or ignorance about or and all. And you can even hate somebody because they're white. And, you know, that doesn't mean that hate crimes, you know, or that kind of stuff doesn't happen. But if somebody were to hate you because you were black and assault you versus if somebody were to hate me because I was white and assault me, odds are the person who assaults me is actually going to face the consequences of assaulting me, whereas the person who insulted you, it's not a guarantee. So that's kind of my defining line as to why white people can't really experience. We can experience bigotry and we can experience hate, but we can't experience racism because it's just, it's all of it combined. And so that's just my opinion. So,
no. It makes a lot of sense.
This, if you don't mind, to Polly.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So basically that, you know, white folks can experience racism, especially when you're dating outside of your race, your culture, or your ethnicity. And basically if anyone out here is saying anything belligerent against a couple that's interracial, and if it's the black person's black culture, black side of it saying, hey, what are you doing with this person or what are you doing with that? That's in a way, it's a part of discrimination and it's a part of way of, you know, stereotyping too. And it's the same thing as if a white person would say that to a black person. So I do believe that if interracial couples are being judged on a court that someone is better than the other, a better color is better than the other, it still has a, it has some form to do with that person is facing that same judgment in a same way, accordance to if we are going to march for Black Lives Matter, and we're marching for certain things, which I think is preposterous because I don't believe in Black Lives Matter. But to Pauly, I will tell you that, yes, that is a part of the racism because they're judgmental of who you choose to love and who you choose to be with and who you feel happy and contented with. And that person, that Black culture is coming from some form of hurt or thinking about what our foreparents have been through. So they're going to be judgmental on anyone that not knowing them, knowing their character, knowing if they're for us or against us, to kind of prejudge your relationship. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. What y'all both said makes sense. I just wanted to get other views on how to like take that in, because I experienced that a lot since I've started dating outside my race.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely, I agree with Ricardo that it makes sense. I'm just saying that I think racism is a multi-tier experience.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to diminish the bigotry and the hatred that people in, you know, mixed relationships deal with, because it's definitely real and it's there. And I'm not trying to diminish that.
No, understood.
And it's a good thing to be a racist, and I think we were talking about this in another segment that I had with another gentleman. It's a great thing to be a racist. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, because if one loved their race, well, anyone loved their race, that means you know about your culture, you know about your foreparents, you know about what you've been through. You are a racist. You became proficient at knowing something. A full definition of what your culture and your race is all about. So it's no longer a prefix. It becomes the suffix. So you're no longer knowing your race. You are proficient at knowing your race, but you become a racist. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, it's the malicious ones behind that word racist, that they're going to be unequal to us, or Black folks is unequal to a certain culture. Now it becomes an inequality of racism. Like, basically, I wasn't born the same way you were born, out of a woman's womb. So what made you more powerful than me? What made you more privileged than me? Hello, stop for a second. So it's the word that we take to this thing to turn it maliciously and thinking it's a bad thing to be a racist. It's not. It's just how Americans, how the world has implement this word in order for it to be so hurtful and to be a topic of discussion. Somebody is going to talk proficiently about their own culture and their skin color.
That's an interesting perspective, though, because you're taking, there's two different meanings to one word.
Yes.
Is basically what it is. So if you're, how can I say that?
If you're comfortable
in your own culture, in your own skin color, yes, and you're proficient in it, you know about it. So you can be a racist, but not a bad racist. Are you guys following that?
Yeah, but also there's a thing of white isn't really a culture. Like, I can sit there and say that I have German and I have Irish and I have, you know, Dutch and I have part Indian, and those are all separate cultures. But white in and of itself really isn't a culture. You know what I mean?
Truth. So take it that white folks have came from another color that made them be that color. That's fine. Okay. I think substantially throughout, if we all believe in God and if we think that there's a heavenly creator, he all created culture for us. He all created life for us. He all created the equality of everything for us on this earth and the universe. Now, substantially, where we've gone wrong is not noticed in the north and south in Africa. There was a division of tribes and cultures and races, race, and they split. Some went more to the north where it's more cold. Some went to the south where it's more hotter. So basically, in the sense of whoever lost their pigmentation, they still had culture. But through along the way, a lot of folks have lost their way. And everyone is clinging on to something that they feel like could be, I'm loving idols, or I'm believing in the gods, or whatever they choose to in their own equilibrium or their own psychosis, that's their choice. Now, the fact of knowing that white people who say that they don't have culture, I would not go as far and say all white people is this and all white people is that. I judge someone on the accord of how their character is and what they have done to me and what they have done in a whole situation. So we will go and say there's a KKKs, there's a white militias, there's this militias, whatever the case is. That's a group. These are groups. This is not the whole universe. This is not the whole world is feeling this way. So on the more common thinking is that I have to think to myself that if I could go outside and meet every single white person, and if I have the ignorance in me as a black man to know what they have done to my foreparents, they have did to this, they have did to that, and I know my history, I know my culture, and I know where I'm coming from. If I was supposed to be judgmental, I have 5 grandkids. They're all white. They're mixed with black. And I have 2 daughters that's mixed with Indian, African, Jamaican, Cuban, and they're all exotic, and they go to it. So I have to be mindful that when it comes to colors and culture, I think we do have it. I think that we just look beyond where we're coming from, because now we're in the Western civilization where we're all being stirred up and conjured up by the media and the government that is run by these fascist groups.
Well, I'm going to stop this one there because I want to keep on going with these questions. And he makes some valid points. Sarah makes valid points. And I think we really need to take them all into consideration because this is a topic and a discussion that can go on for hours.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have to be cognizant of the time, but also, so I'm going to, and I, Ricardo, I actually, you're the last one for the question. So, you know, with the racism and bigotry, you know, has it had a direct impact on your life? And if you, can you give us just an example?
Yes, sir. Well, since I've been with the Black Caucus. I'm also an advocate. I'm an advocate. I'm a philanthropist, and a humanitarian. And my grandparents is coming from Fidel Castro and Che Guevara's era, revolutionaries.
Mm-hmm.
Also, my foreparents is from Ghana, from Accra, and my kids' them parents is from South Africa, Johannesburg, and also Dar es Salaam. So my history and my thing that I've been through in my life, I've faced racism since I moved to Canada when I was living in Sudbury, Ontario. I used to be called monkey, coconut. These things forced me to take my dad's kitchen meat cleaver and put it in my bag. My best friend in Sudbury up to this day is a white guy. And I remember that he used to fight for me, break his hands in his own white people's face. And I used to tell him, why you do this for me? He was like, you know what? You're my best friend. And I don't want nobody call you no nigger, no monkey, no coconut, no none of that, right? So, you know, I as a young kid, I was like, what, 9, 10 years old? You know what I'm saying? So going to school with a meat cleaver, I was aware a long time that no one was going to get away with calling me those kind of names, you know? So I took it upon my duty to know where my grandparents was coming from, experiencing that at a young age. And as I got older, when there was a Premier Mike Harris that was of Canada, of Ontario, you know, there was a lot of racism then too. And they didn't want black folks here in Canada from 1906. They were trying to stop black folks from coming into Canada. So my poor parents and my parents came and they worked hard. My dad is still working at 74 years old. You know, we don't want to stop him because if he will die. So we just let him do his thing because he knows where he's coming from. He gives you all the stories and tell you about the names that he used to be called, spit it on, until he decided one day to do the same thing. He says, I'm going to die. If you ever spit on me again, I'm going to kill you. And my dad stood up. My grandparents always stood up. I went to the States, even in Louisiana, in New Orleans, down in Bourbon Street. I was on Bourbon Street in a restaurant eating. I love seafood. I love crawfish. So Bourbon Street, you could get anything you want down there. So, you know, I was on Bourbon Street. I was in one of the restaurants and stuff. So, you know, the waitress came and stuff like that. And I was with my wife at the time and my two daughters. And she came and she says, basically, we don't want your kind in here. I was like, okay, well, since I was a black guy, that was really, like, at that point, like, okay, I got money. I got a lot of things going on. No problem. Let me make a few calls here. So she embarrassed me. So I told my wife and the kids, go back to the hotel room. And my ignorance got the best of me because I got arrested that day down in New Orleans in Bourbon Street because I trashed their place. My friends came and I told the waitress, I want you to repeat what you said. But my kind, what is my kind? Niggers? Blacks? Like what? I don't understand. And she mentioned it and a couple white guys were around. I could see that they were, you know, rednecks. I could see that they were ready to go. So I was ready to go too. So I flipped the table. I flipped the table, messed the place up. And then my friends were outside. And then one of my friends broke the window and it would be like, oh, niggers are not allowed here, eh? And then the police came, and of course, no white person got arrested. We did, and I bailed everybody out the same night. So I experienced that racism, but I learned in America through my life. I've learned that if you're not a black person who stand up and make your foreparents be proud of you, you're gonna die in vain. And I think if you don't die for a reason and don't die for a cause, or stand up for a reason and stand up for a cause, people is always gonna be taking advantage of you because people prey on the weak. They strive off of sucking your energy, and they strive off of those things. So I've learned as a black man where I'm coming from in my history and my culture. I decided to myself is that my head is never down. My head is always held high because there have to be something about me as a black man why people fear. And it's not saying all white people fear that, because a lot of white people is comfortable in their skins. I love them. Me and them chill out, smoke together, drink together, party together, listen to my reggae music, Spanish music together, Africana music together. And they're non-judgmental. Mm. I love those ones that I have. So, you know, that's my side of racism. Mm. And there's a lot more, but we don't have enough time. Maybe on the next segment.
We don't have enough time for more. Because that's a whole other show.
Yes,
I mean, good. That was enough. That was enough for me. I mean, I guess mine. Let's see. We'll, because we're actually going to wind up cutting this. I'm not going to get to all the questions today. We're going to have to do it in the next one. But the my experience, I guess, was interesting, to say the least, to whereas I was where I belonged, but someone assumed that I didn't belong there. Okay. I'll never forget this. I had my home, and it was in a upper scale area, and it was my home. And I was outside doing the lawn, and it usually took me like about 4 hours because it was a large property. It was sitting on an acre. And the one thing that got me was I'm sitting there doing it, and it's hotter than hell, and I'm just miserable listening to my music. And the dude comes walking up, and he says, "Is the owner of the house around?" and I know, and this is so. I look at him, and I'm like, "So how can I help you?" Right? And he says it again, "Is the owner of the house around?" Mind you, I don't want to give the area or anything, but some of my neighbors were NFL players. Okay, so this is that kind of neighborhood. One, you know, it's, you usually don't have people walking around. And, you know, this went back and forth about two or three times before it just dawned on me, because I really wasn't in the mood. And then it dawned on me, it was like the guy, he's like, yeah, I'm looking to talk to the homeowner. And I said, you're talking to a man. And I just had it. And it was to the point to where, as at that time, I had a really big dog, and he was a vicious dog. And I'm about to let the dog out and just finish this, because I got some fool out here trying to just, I don't know, act like a fool. But you know what? It didn't occur to me till after that incident. Why? Because it was the color of my skin. That's why. They didn't think that somebody could live in that area being that color.
Wow.
It was a shame. It's a shame. You know, you do everything right. You do, you abide by the laws, by the rules. You don't bother anybody. I'm an introvert, man. I don't go out and seek trouble. I try to help people when I can, you know, if it ever comes across my path or I need to go out and do something. But again, that was just one. I mean, I've had plenty more, but that was one that really, like, listening to, like, Austin, listening to, you know, Polly and Sarah. Sometimes, you know, they say the term is hindsight's 20/20. You know?
Yeah.
And you don't really figure out until it's all over. That's what that was all about. So that's my little one instance. So we'll move on. But listen, let's do this last one, and then we're actually going to need more time for the others, because this is some pretty in-depth stuff, man. This one's going to probably eat up the rest of our time. So, Polly,
yes,
you ready?
Sir.
She said that ominously. Yes. Austin.
Hello.
Hello, sir. Just making sure you're still with us. And then Sarah, you're still good, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, just making sure. All right, so here we go. So check this out. So this question, this one's gonna be good. So although social justice movements have occurred in the past, and we know which ones those are, do you feel that this movement right now, the change that we're seeing right now, and I'm going to also put outside of that, just force outside of your mind, COVID-19, throw that out. Do you believe that this movement now is different? And if you do believe so, how so is it different than the previous ones? Polly.
Okay, so I'm not going to lie. Honestly, when it first started, I felt it was different. But I don't think we're there yet for the different that we need to actually see more changes that actually will benefit us in the future. Because it died down too fast. Like, soon as the next popular thing came up, it was just like, okay, just gone, just whatever. And then it's not like everything that we were asking for, they beat around the bush on it. Like, we want equality, we want to be treated like humans, and they're just like, okay, we're gonna paint Black Lives Matter on the road. I'm like, okay, that's, we're like, that's nice, thank you for acknowledging that. But we want equality. We want to be treated like humans. And they're just like, okay, well, we're just going to change the street name to Black Lives Matter Boulevard. Oh, we get that, but can you please? And it's just not there yet. And then it's dying down in the media. So everyone's just like, well, no, not everyone, but most of the people are just like, okay, let's move on to something else. And we're just not there yet. It's going to take a lot more before we actually get there. That's just my opinion, though.
Yep. That's
a good one. I concur. Ricardo said I concur. So yeah, I like that. That I agree with that too. Austin,
hello.
Talk to us.
I feel it's extremely different. Well, at the beginning, because there's only so much peacefulness you can do until people start needing to learn. So you have to start burning stuff down. I don't like the looting thing was other people taking the opportunity, but people started listening, actually listening, whenever we were burning stuff down. And if it takes some destruction for to get some equality, that's fine. I agree with it 100%. Because people don't listen until you start threatening their stuff. Because they're changing all the wrong things. Like, wait, we talked about this yesterday, but like let's say they changed the Angel Mama. Like, we just want to, it's just equality. Like, that's not helping at all. Like, there shouldn't be random, like, just people dying, whether they were guilty or not dying. Or like, I'll see on social media, I'll be like, cops kill white people too. Well, why aren't you mad? Cops kill Hispanics too. Why aren't you mad? Like, the problem is that there's only one group of people angry and everybody else is trying to deflect the problem. But
And go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just going to piggyback on that.
I talked to Polly about this, but like, if burning my house down means a better step towards equality, then burn it down. That makes sense.
It's just material.
I know it's crazy, but
it means not us burning it down, but like if there was a riot in our neighborhood and they're like, we're going to burn it down until they start listening because we do live in a predominantly white neighborhood, then burn it down. It's just stuff. We can replace it.
Like, I have insurance. I'll get the money back. Like, it would suck. It would be a hassle, but like, if it means equality, then yeah, burn it down. Yeah. That's just how I feel. Like, we can burn this whole country down until we get equality.
Even if it's can I piggyback on Austin and Miss Polly's point here? I mean, to be honest with you, Spiff, you think about the riots that's been happening, Watts riots, if it's been happening in Baltimore riots, Washington riots, Chicago riots. When you think about burning these communities and burning these houses down, regardless, these are hardworking people too. And I wrote a piece long time ago on what we were talking about, burning other things down, and black folks communities down, and they never had no gas, they didn't have a gas station, they had no food markets, didn't have nothing because they burned those resources. The key is, I think to myself, is our neighborhoods as black community, I think that we need to see that the problem is within us, in a sense of we lost our community, we lost our our activism, we lost our sense of knowing that every company in this country of United States or Canada, anywhere you go, make money off of colored people because we buy the most goods. We do a lot of things. So the thing is that we don't have enough people around us to educate us on that. We need to stop burning because we've been burning. And we lost our way when Martin Luther King said that, you know, we believe in affirmative actions and all we do is marches. So people is used to us doing marches because there's no solution after the marches. It's just going to die down. Now, like what Polly says, which is true, they're going to give us a street sign like they did Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Harriet Tubman, and the rest of the black folks that died for us. They give us these street signs and they give us these ghettos, these gentrified areas that's predominantly blacks and Hispanic neighborhoods. And they still hold us down to show us that our goal is to keep them down psychologically, and their equality, we should not be marching for equality. There's no living life on this earth, on this planet, should be marching for equality and to be recognized to be equal. Now, what we need to do is to make them realize that, yes, I respect Austin's point to say, if we have to die for some, let's die for some, but let's not burn it down in a sense. But what we do is that what the NFAC right now in Georgia is doing is saying an eye for an eye, like Malcolm X, that's set. And the NFAC right now is marching in Stone Mountain, where the Ku Klux Klan birthplace of them is birded. And they're saying, okay, remember when the 4th of July, they said, hey, you said if black people's out at certain times, you're going to kill them and do this to a black woman and children. And so we said to them, okay, fine. You take one of ours, we're going to start killing white people at a certain time too. So we're matching now the changes that we're matching violence with violence, and we're telling them their rhetoric with their rhetoric. So, but we still have to think about the smart that we have to do within our community. We have to organize our community much better to teach the young generation that is coming beneath us not to take up the same germs as what we're dealing with now, in order to teach them and educate them on if they're going to be in politics, Senate, the House of Representatives, in order to help black folks make the rules for themselves instead of depending on other races and ethnicities to make the rules for black culture and the way we live for black lives. That's what we need to stop.
Agreed.
That's a great point.
No, he just answered. He answered the question.
Yeah, he did.
Sarah's like, well, guess what? Sarah's next.
I swear, this is such a loaded, layered question that I see, like, everybody's valid in what they're saying. Correct. And I do think that this movement is definitely different. But my biggest thing is that it seems to be the line that this movement hit middle America. This movement, you know, you have so many of these equality movements and all these, and it was kind of confined to just those, you know what I mean? Like the people in that movement. Now you have like George Floyd changed that, because white middle America has been always fed this narrative when it comes to these types of situations. You know what I mean? Like even cases like Trayvon Martin and stuff, like we're always fed this narrative of, well, maybe he, you know what I mean? Like he could have been doing something illegal. He could have been doing this. And the way that everything happened with George Floyd, with him not doing it, you know what I mean? He wasn't resisting. He was he was this, that I think that made middle America and white America have to open their eyes to, like, oh shit, you know, the narrative that we've been fed is not the way that it really is.
Correct.
And I think that happening has made it so, like, you know, all this other time before, like you have every other race or culture and they were kind of like talking to themselves. And I think the big change is that people are more willing, of all races, to have conversations like these, which I think conversations like these are the key to having it go past being just a protest or just a this, and have it be in the realm of the more we talk, the more we learn, the more we get insights, and the more that we are more willing to listen, the more we're going to turn, you know, a protest into the next step of our money and our vote. Because in America, that's what matters, is your money. Where are you going to put your money? Where are you not going to put your money? You know, who are you going to support? Who are you going to vote for? Who are you going to this? And I think that's a big part of it. It has to go from just, I'm trying to think of the word that I mean. A different type of action. And yes, and it's one of those that, you know, we have an administration that is very much trying to hold on to race baiting as their platform. I definitely see everybody's point. You know, I agree with the fact that people are giving the wrong things, but the people that are giving the wrong things are the people that they're doing it because your money affects them.
Correct.
You know, Aunt Jemima, we're going to get rid of Aunt Jemima because, you know, it might be that, well, that's because they want you to buy their product. Yeah. And we're at the point where people need to be, and it's something that, like, in my house, we've taken very serious of looking where you spend your money on, what that fuels, like what that corporation or how they run this or how they run that, how they wield their power and their influence, and to take your money away from that. And it has to be, and I don't mean to say this disparaging, anybody can protest, and it's a very, you can go out and do it, but you have to be smart to go to the next level and think about how to take it from just a protest to a collective action. Because change is going to listen with your money and your vote.
Correct. Welcome to Capitalism 101.
I agree with Sarah. Like, it started off different, and the protest just, it touched the whole world, but that's because everyone saw his death. But if we can make people understand that, can you care about the ones that Steph didn't get videotaped too? Because Breonna Taylor, she didn't get, she don't have any kind of justice right now, even though she was a citizen that was living by the law, doing her due diligence, and no one's talking about it, but other Black females who's trying to, well, there's other people, but the main people that's pushing it is Black females, and everyone's just like, okay, we'll get to her later. And I'm like, no, it's no later. This young woman lost her life. Her boyfriend got sent to jail for protecting their house legally, and no one's causing an uproar. And that's why I said we're not there yet, because until you start caring about the deaths that's not getting videotaped and put in public, we can never be there. We're not at that level of consciousness yet.
And I agree with that. And unfortunately, I also agree with the estate. I hate that I agree with it, but it's also the fact that, you know, I think Black women are probably one of the most devalued people in society, kind of thing, where we have, you know what I mean? Like, especially in a lot of white households. And it's just a thing. And it's like, I guess the best example is when the Black Lives Matter movement first started, the news spin on it that was directed to white America was like, you would hear stories like, well, they, like the people who founded this, they think white people should sell their homes and white, you know what I mean? So like the division was there before even the facts came out. And I think that's a big part of the problem, is that, you know, the media and the true owners of this country, those four really wealthy people who own and run everything, they want that. They want us to be divided. And, you know, I don't know how to say this with saying it correctly, but like, all other minorities know the reality. White people and have to learn the reality, because it's not what is given to us. Our narrative is very different from the way things are. And that plays a big role in it, is that, you know, you have to actually take the time to look and look into and check all sorts of different sources to actually get the true picture. So it's kind of like, I can't think of a term. I'm sorry. I can't think of the word I'm trying to think of. And it's just, it's there's white America and then there's everybody else. And it sucks to have to say that, but that's what it is.
Well, you know, I do apologize, everybody. We got to wrap it up here. It's fine. We're going to have to do this again, another episode. But here's the deal. My thoughts real quick, and I'm going to play this for you. It's powerful. I'm sure you've seen the video of her speech. My goodness. Kimberly Jones. She was an author. She is an author. And she made such a compelling speech that it blew me away. And she said one thing at the end of that speech, and I'm going to play that for you all right now and for our listeners. And I've played it before in another episode, so if you recognize it, bear with me. But it's very important to me, because everything she said was spot on, and how she described what we've been going through for 400 years. And she was spot on, and it brought a tear to my eye, because you feel the pain. You feel that pain, and it's not anger anymore. It's just pain that as human beings, you couldn't even, in 400 years, you couldn't even find a sense of decency. But before I continue and give you my opinion on this movement, let me play this for you real quick.
As far as I'm concerned, they could burn this bitch to the ground, and it still wouldn't be enough. And they are lucky that what Black people are looking for is equality and not revenge.
That to me...
This was the Monopoly, right? When she compared it to Monopoly?
Correct. And she was spot on.
Yeah, she was.
And, I'm sorry about the Sam and Jackson one. That's my favorite. But I have to say about that, Ricardo hit on that with what's going on, what happened in Atlanta with that march. Austin hit on it. Polly hit on it. Sarah, you hit on it. You know, the bottom line is that people should be thankful that they're not looking for revenge, that people are not looking for revenge. And I'm not going to say racist. I'm going to say people. I'm not going to say whether black, white, or Hispanic. Yes. Be thankful that human beings are not looking for revenge to go out there and take out that anger on innocent people. That's the reality of it. That we have the ability to have a peaceful conversation, even in the face of evil. Even in the face of evil, because what happened to Ahmaud Arbery, what happened to Breonna Taylor, what happened to George Floyd, what happened to Elijah McClain. What happened to all these people was evil. There is no way on God's green earth that you can sit there and tell me any different, because there's a person in their right mind doesn't do what these people did.
They're in your right
Those
mind.
Cops.
They are in their right mind.
Huh?
They are in their right mind.
They're in their right mind. No, hold on a second. You're right. In their right mind of thinking for the way that they think. But if you go to the general masses of decent humans, human being, decency outside of the United States, let's say. Think about that for a minute. Outside of this country, when you talk to people who, and I'm going to touch this one, Ricardo, when you, Rastafarians.
Yes.
Okay, peaceful people. Peace.
Yes.
They welcome you with open arms. That's the kind of thought process that I'm talking about. When you talk about those kinds of people, that's when I refer to common sense.
Common sense.
Because they have it. They have it. They so again, going back to those cops, going back to the ones that killed Breonna, the one that had his damn knee on George's neck.
Yeah.
That's evil. Because again, even in their warped thinking, in their jaded thinking, they still had an opportunity to say, this isn't right. They still had an opportunity before they went into her house, into her apartment, and started just shooting up the place like it was the OK Corral. They had an opportunity to say, man, we might want to think this through.
It was initiation. I think it's an initiation.
Of course. It's an initiation to do whatever the hell we want to do.
Yeah, it's initiation. I mean, you have to think about it. That's what I mentioned in the segment, that it's hard to judge police officers. It's hard to judge what, you know, a white police officer does, because when I said to the Black Caucus to try to pass a bill to make everybody in the police force or military get a lie detector test to see who is for you, to see who is for the country, who's for community, and who's for the people. And I think that would be one of the best valid things that to do for any government official, to do a lie detector test to see if these people are KKKs, Black white supremacy, Asian, it doesn't matter. But if you find out that people's here and they're genuine human beings and they're here to serve and protect, they're here to mm-hmm. take good care of human beings and law and govern us the right way with equality, then we will know what police officer is wearing the badge of honor. But we can't just judge all white police officers. The only time we make this mess happen is when a white officer does these things and we say, oh my God, he is a part of the Grand Wizard, or, you know,
no.
and stuff like that. So it's crazy. You know, it's kind of like a touchy subject, and it's scary to say that we employ and hire people to serve and protect us in our community, and we don't know who's who.
But here's
can I touch on something that Ricardo said? Because I agree with everything that he said. But I think it's also, it's more of like, you know, we have a real problem where the police are only policed by the police.
Correct.
And I think it's more than just racism. I think it's the unmitigated power.
Brotherhood.
That blue line of... Mm-hmm. of this power over people, kind of like Austin said earlier, and I've heard my daughter say too, when people want to throw up, well, you know, yeah, I get the whole like percentages, but technically cops kill more white people. Why isn't everybody mad? Why aren't you mad that they're abusing their authority over everybody?
You're right.
And the only people that are they answer to are themselves.
Exactly.
You know, and it's only right. And it's like, look at what happened in Portland with the troops, or I forget what they're technically called.
They're actually border patrol.
With he was a 65-year-old white man, but he was a veteran.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody saw that video. And he didn't do anything. He was standing there and he was talking to them and he was saying, correct, what about your oath? What about your this? What about your, you know, that? And they beat him. They broke his hand in two places and pepper sprayed him twice. And, you know, and it's one of those things where there's something about this entire administration. And this is the part that always gets me the most, is that I've never seen any administration be so blatant in their corruption, in their lies, in their abuse of power. And like, we literally have a president who is acting like a dictator.
Mm-hmm.
And we are so numb to it as a society that it's not even shocking.
Sarah, sorry to talk about, no disrespect, because I love the way you talk and I want to ask you something quick.
Okay,
so this new president, right? I mean, Donald Trump, right? Think about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you want a president to have things still be swept under the rug? Or do we want a president like himself to expose the bigotry, to expose the racism, to expose these things?
That's transparent.
That's current and apparent. So it's a bad thing to say you have a douche like that running the country with no sense of emotions or a sense of knowing anything. But in the next sense, isn't it good that he's shining the spotlight on these things so we can actually attack it more?
I mean, I get what you're saying, but here's the thing. I don't know if anybody ever read the Mueller report when it came out, but it was actually in the Mueller report that one of the charges was that, what's his name, Putin, wanted to incite race riots in the United States.
Wow.
And I think if it was a thing where it was kind of like, I don't know, any sort of intelligence behind it, any thought behind it, it would be an easier pill to swallow. But he's inciting race because of the fact that it, for his best interest, for his money, for his reelection, for his this. And, you know, I don't think he's a smart man. And he's just, you know what I mean? And he would be willing to just completely fuck up the country for his own pockets.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I know that we have to end soon, but I just want to say a quick little thing.
Yeah, we got
to
end now.
It's good that he's showing his bigotry and his racism. The only problem is him showing it so outright and just in our face is giving people like him a boost to commit more hate crimes and to openly show their hatred, which is why so many racists, as in the bad racists, is coming out now, because they see the president do it, so why can't they? So it's a good thing that he's showing it, but it's also bad thing too.
I agree with what you're saying too, Polly, and I'm writing an article about it right now, because like, here's the thing, we're noticing it in his supporters, because I'm gonna be really, this is just my opinion, Trump won not because more of America thinks like him. Trump won the election for a lot of reasons. I think that because Hillary Clinton stole the election, the nomination, you had people who were voting against Hillary. You have people, you know what I mean? Because the country isn't decided by the extreme left or the extreme right. The country's, you know, the fate of the elections are decided by the people in the middle, by the people who are just kind of like, maybe I'll vote this way, maybe I'll vote that way. And middle America, they were voting against Hillary, but they were also voting against the system. So yes, you had a lot of racists that were voting against the Obama administration, but you had a lot of people who were like, he's just not a politician and I'm tired of politicians. So you're seeing so much ugly from his supporters because that's what's left of who voted for him. I think most of the people who voted for Trump were voting against other things, and I don't think they're on his side now. And I think the only people that are left on his side are that extreme right. That extreme, so, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we're gonna.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. We got it. We really have to end this here. So listen, I want to thank everybody for being on the show today. We're going to pick this up because there's a lot. We didn't even get through all of our questions. There's a lot to go on. We have just a lot of content. So want to thank you guys for being on. Polly, Austin, Sarah, Ricardo, thank you for everything today. And thank you for all your insight. And this is what's going to help build a better future for all of us. Also, our listeners, hey, I want to thank you guys for listening as well. It has been a long episode. Thank you for hanging in there. Stay tuned for another episode. We'll go ahead and continue this conversation. It's something that needs to be continued. Stay safe out there and have a wonderful day, everyone. Thank you.